What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Jeffrey Konis, author of the new book, The Conversations We Never Had. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Maybe Not on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim Barel Kachar and Leah Avuno, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This week in the Northern Hemisphere, we'll have the longest days of the year, the summer solstice, when the sun reaches its apex in the sky. In many religious traditions, the summer solstice is celebrated as a kind of festival. That's geographic, too, in Scandinavia, where the midsummer days are nearly endless. Actually, in the northern parts of Scandinavia, they are endless. Museums and shops close for a midsummer holiday around June 21st, and people take mini vacations and hold parties to celebrate, even dancing around a maypole and wearing flowers in their hair. Originally, in pagan traditions, midsummer day was the time to go to sacred sites and see the sun rise, often watching it come up through a wholly astronomically oriented stone construction. This was true of Stonehenge and Avebury's Stone Circle in Britain and in sites dedicated to Li, the Chinese goddess of light in China. And it was true 6 months later at Machu Picchu in Peru when the summer solstice for the southern hemisphere occurred. When Christianity came along, it changed the pagan summer solstice celebrations it discovered into festivals commemorating the birth of John the Baptist, a kind of summer parallel to the winter solstice celebration of Jesus' supposed day of birth. In India, in Hindu tradition, a yoga festival associated with the summer solstice, Guru Purnima, is held, although actually it's at the first full moon after the summer solstice. Anyway, very likely, our entire species, humanity's first religious connections were made with the sun, whose rising has always been associated with hope, light, energy, growth, and the flourishing of light. That led me to wonder. So many ancient cultures focused on the sun as the source of all creation. You can see that clearly at nearly every sacred site in the world. And I have personally visited most of them, from England to Turkey to Egypt to Cambodia to Indonesia to Mexico. It's almost axiomatic that ancient religions began with some form of sun worship. Yet Judaism did not do that. Instead, it decided very early on that God was not the sun or in the sun or the solar disk or any other representation of the fiery burning ball of hydrogen we see in the sky. God was more than that. God was the creator of the sun, and there would be no Jewish temples or stone circles or special sacred astronomical compasses dedicated to a solar lord. Even the Jewish calendar revolved around the phases of the moon, which was also not worshipped, but used as a kind of timepiece, allowing us to know where we were in the month and year. While every new moon is celebrated in a minor way in Judaism as Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month, there is no observance associated with the sun, or almost none. In Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, the Sfirot, the 10 spheres that encapsulate the various aspects of the divine, include a fair number of astronomical references. But even here, the most important of the Sfirot, Shechinah or Malchut, is related to the moon, not the sun. There is no important Jewish festival connected with the sun. Still, when you look closely, you can see a bit of solar image, even in Judaism. There's an obscure observance called the Birkat HaChama, the special blessing of the sun, when it returns once every 28 years to what our tradition says was its original position when it was created. We did this Birkat HaChama, this blessing of the sun, back in the year 2009. And for those of us who are still planning to be around in the year 2037, and I hope you all are, we will again have a chance to go outside and do the blessing, thanking God for creating the sun. But obviously, a blessing you only do once every 28 years cannot be said to be central to Judaism. We also know that almost every synagogue in the world has its ark on the eastern wall, and that's the direction we face in prayer. That also faces the rising sun, but that's actually a coincidence, because most synagogues are located west of Jerusalem. If you are in a country east of Israel, the orientation is west, facing the Holy Land, and that's where the ark is, and that's the direction you're supposed to pray. However, there is a Talmudic story, a Midrash, that says that a convert to Judaism, Queen Helena of the Assyrian or perhaps Persian province of Adiabene, had a golden candlestick made over the door of the temple in Jerusalem so that when the sun rose, its rays were reflected from the candlestick, and everybody knew it was the time for reading the Shema. Well, in any case, on this coming longest day of the year, this summer solstice, be aware of the fact that even Jews have some minor religious connection to the sun that brings light and heat to the world. And it's never wrong to thank God for the beauty of the natural world and its creation. To play us in this morning, here's Israeli singer Yonina, her new song, Rega Mechuvan, an intentional moment.
לאן ברח היום, הוא רק התחיל וכבר עזל
תזכירי מה חיפשתי בכלל
הכל רועש לי בפנים ובחוץ לא להפסיק לרוץ
ממה אתה לחוץ? כשכל דקה רודפת השנייה הופכת אהבה למטלה נוחתת שוב בלילה במיטה
לנו ארצת דפלי הקרב הבא האם אני בדרך למנוחה ולנחלה
רודפת אופקים, עוקפת שבילים נותנת לפקקים, נגע לי על העצבים
לכל רגע שמחה היא רק מעבר לפינה במרחק שנשימה אז איך זוכים לאריכות ימים שכל רגע מכוון וממלא אותי בפנים רוצה לחפוץ בחיים לאהוב את הימים לראות טוב טוב רק טוב עצר ומרים מבט
רואים יותר כשהולכים לאט
וכמה זה פשוט פשוט להיות ולחוות ולהודות
נפסיקה לעמוד מהצד
אני יודע השמחה היא רק מעבר לפינה במרחק של נשימה אז איך זוכים לאריכות ימים שכל רגע מכוון וממלא אותי בפנים רוצה לחפוץ בחיים לאהוב את הימים לראות טוב
That was Rega Mechuvan by Israeli singer Yonina. Our guest this morning, Jeffrey Konis, has written a new book that redefines what a memoir is. It's called The Conversations We Never Had. Meet him when we return in a moment, right here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Jeffrey Konis is the author of the book, The Conversations We Never Had. He practiced law, became a high school social studies teacher, and then wrote a remarkably imagined book about conversations he wished he'd had with his grandparents and strongly affecting their experience coming out of Europe and through the Holocaust. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good morning to you as well.
So what prompted you to write the book in the first place?
I had actually watched a television program where a grandson and his grandmother enjoyed a particularly intimate, warm, wonderful relationship. And she happened to have been a Holocaust survivor. And they would travel together and talk together. And they lived in the same building and so forth. And all of a sudden it had hit me that I had lived with my grandmother, who was actually my father's aunt, for over 2 years. And I never had asked her any questions about her experiences in the Holocaust. I never asked her about my dad's real parents, her sister being his mother. My father has no recollection of what his own father looked like. There are no photographs of his dad, and there's only one photograph of his real mom, and that's when she's approximately 10 years old, and that's actually on the cover of the book. So that was really the original impetus for me. It really, frankly, angered me and upset me, and I had to do something, and the first thought that came to mind was, I'm going to write a book.
You know, second-generation survivors, third-generation survivors, it's a phenomenon that's well-known in the Jewish world but not always so well-known outside. There's an impact to people and how each family has dealt with those memories. It differs tremendously, doesn't it?
It does, but someone else I was talking to also had the impression that, you know, these are topics that are difficult to talk about. A lot of people don't want to discuss it. It's too painful and so forth. My dad, who was a survivor himself from Vilna, barely got out of there alive. He wouldn't volunteer any information, but he would gladly sit down with you and tell you anything and everything you wanted to know. He was very matter-of-fact about everything. My grandma Ola, again, my step-grandmother, if you will, she would have done exactly the same thing. But the stories that I had wanted most from her were not necessarily about her Holocaust experiences. You know, my father could give me some insight as to that, but the real information I wanted her was, I wanted to know something about my grandparents. I mean, she could have told me in a 5-second conversation what my grandfather looked like, and then I, in turn, could have spoken to my father and say to him, I know what your dad looked like.
And it never happened.
And it never happened over the course of 2.5 years.
And that became the impetus for a really interesting book. We'll talk much more with Jeffrey Konis about his book, The Conversations We Never Had, and the way he kind of created that world. And we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2jewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Israel and Saudi Arabia do not seem to make very good bedfellows. And by tradition, Saudi Arabia was extremely anti-Israel, funded terrorism, was part of the network that worked against the Zionist entity. But for the last few years, that's been changing. And the Saudis have developed clandestine and sometimes even open relations with Israel that didn't exist before. This doesn't have very much to do with Israel, though, does it?
I think it has to do with two larger, longer-term trends. One is a certain liberalization within the kingdom itself, the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, within the royal family, whatever. They've always been incredibly hypocritical, and they've always like gone to Vegas and hired hookers and gotten drunk and all the things that are prohibited by
Islam. As soon as they
Islam.
Get on the plane for Paris, the right. clothes come off, the suits, you know, it's all fancy. And
so a little bit of that hypocrisy is falling away, and quite recently, women have been granted like six basic rights that they never had before, and it's far from full equality, but much greater, let's say, normalization than was ever imaginable in Saudi Arabia. And I think, generally speaking, there's a trend towards greater modernization, greater accountability, greater normalization, if not westernization, of Saudi Arabia in general. Who's the biggest model of a functioning democracy that's fairly egalitarian and free and respectful of human rights in the region? Israel. So it's natural for them to look to Israel as a model in some ways. But the other long-term trend is something we've talked about before on your show, and that is there are essentially three power centers in the Islamic world that have always competed against each other for leadership of that world. And it has nothing to do with population size or even wealth. It has to do with cultures. There's the Persian culture, which is Iran, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, largely, some parts of other neighboring countries. But there's that set of languages, beliefs, practices, et cetera, et cetera. And that is largely Shiite. There's the Arab set, which is mostly Sunni, it doesn't include Iranians or Turks or Afghans or Indonesians or anybody else. It's Arabs, and the leader of the Arab world, by virtue of its money, has always been the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Which is also where Mecca and Medina are the holiest sites, and therefore that has a tremendous
Right, and they've always
power.
Had a special place in U.S. foreign policy because we valued their oil too much to treat them the way we treat any other state. And the third candidate for leadership in the Islamic world, which for about seven centuries was the undisputed leader of the Islamic world, was Turkey and Turkic places, which include not only Turkey, but also Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, basically all the stans except for Tajikistan and Afghanistan. You see this as the real undercurrent behind Middle Eastern politics today. And I think the Saudis feel threatened by the Iranis and by Shia in general, and they see the enemy of my enemy as my friend. So it's logical for them to cultivate a less hostile relationship with Israel.
Thanks, Tom. A great overview. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinit on Israel, Leah Avuno, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Leah.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Leah, you've spent now almost a full year here, and
yes.
You're getting to the latter stages of your time. You came from an interesting region, a partnership region for our federation, the Kiryat Malachi, but you also came from an Orthodox background, Orthodox Ethiopian Jewish background. Your observations, tell us a little bit about your experience here.
So, yes, I did grow up in a really Orthodox town, not town, but my neighborhood, and I went to only girls Orthodox religious school, and let's say that every day I was in the synagogue, every day that I prayed. And when I came here, I didn't know a lot about Reform Judaism or Conservative Judaism, and I didn't know you can be Jewish in so many different ways. I know that everybody take Judaism to their own perspective and, you know, different lifestyle because I'm Ethiopian and our traditions are a little bit different from other people because we were isolated for so many years and we go by the actual Torah and less, you know, But with the time, you know, the generation of the Ethiopian Jews became part of the Israeli society. So I wasn't, you know, I never felt different. And when I came here, I was exposed to so many different beautiful Jewish culture, and I never thought about even the opportunity of sitting with my family in a synagogue and praying together. It will always be like me standing in like on the top of the Beit Knesset and like
in
trying
the women's
to look
gallery,
some,
like trying to look down on the rest of your family.
Yeah, like I would bring a chair from my house just to stand on it so I can see maybe something. So I love Orthodox Judaism. It's just really fun to be exposed to so many different ways of being Jewish. And you know, the first time I came to Temple Emmanuel, I cried, and Bar know that. And at first I was like, wait, they didn't say that, and that's a different word in here, and why are they using guitar? And then like I learned to love it. And when I will go back to Israel, I will definitely change my ways of being Jewish, and I will pass it on to my family and friends.
That's fantastic. You know, people think that, you know, Israel is so Jewish. Well, it is. Of course, it's profoundly Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many different expressions that have been cultivated all over the diaspora, especially in America. And it's great that you've had an opportunity to experience it. We were talking before, and I said, at least three times you've come up to me and told me, that's the best service I've ever gone to. Now, you may say that to all the rabbis you meet, but it was really...
Only the reforms. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, it's just amazing to see that for the first time. And again, that's something that I will take to my own personal life, because a lot of people in Israel are secular because they don't feel the connection to Orthodox Judaism, and it takes a lot, you know, and it's not always easy to be Orthodox Judaism, but everybody wants a connection to their Judaism. So now I know that there is a way. Like, it's not just one way. There are a bunch of ways. So
fantastic.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much, Leah. We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov, good morning.
Good morning. So not long ago, you came back from Israel, having co-led the Tucson Hebrew Academy eighth grade trip to Israel. That's an unusual opportunity.
Amazing opportunity. And we took 21 students with us. I was one of three sponsors. And of course, Rabbi Billy Lefkowitz, our trip leader, and terrific guides we had out there, Yaakov Lopez and Omer Hagby, phenomenal Israeli guys who shepherded us around. And, you know, Rabbi, one of the highlights of the trip was going down to the partnership region that Tucson has established with Israel.
So that's in the south, Chof Ashkelon, and that kind of area around Ashkelon,
right.
Ashdod.
Yep, and there's a school there called Shikma, which is kind of a feeder. It's a high school with, I believe, over 1,000 kids who come from all over the region, all the kibbutzim, collective farms in the region. And, excuse me, our students get to know them over the course of the year. And they, so it's not like total strangers meeting, but, they do join together for the first time. And, there's a hilltop in the area. I can't always remember this location, but it's of course a historical landmark where there was an important battle won and everything. And you have this tremendous vista of all the farms around. And so we met up there this time, last time we met at the school. But seeing the groups come together is terrifically exciting. The energy and the excitement, the enthusiasm. We did a little bit of a mixer, and then we went and, you know, basically the second thing we did was we planted trees together. And then, you know, kind of hanging out as the sun is going down and making pizzas. And then the Tucson kids going home to the houses of the students that we met there for home hospitality, and none of them wanting to leave. And all the stories about that overnight experience. The next day we got to do an archaeological dig together, a legitimate actual live dig, and did some beach time and had lunch, and it went like super fast. But the connection, you just know those connections will last for many, many years. And the students still are talking to one another on WhatsApp and sending photos and, you know, sharing their lives together. So building those relationships with Israelis is tremendously powerful and such an important opportunity and really, I believe, an obligation that we have out here, those of us that aren't in Israel. It feels like there are different centers of Judaism these days. You know, there's New York, there's L.A., other great cities
in the world. Arizona, of course. You know.
Right. Mexico City, London,
right.
Australia,
Paris,
South Africa. Right. Right. And yet when you're in Israel, it's almost 360 degrees of being Jewish. And it's a very multicultural nation and community as well. But I think it's so critical for us spread so far around the world to be making those connections and building those relationships so that we don't grow apart from each other. And it's great to see that coming together at our level.
Thanks, John. We will we'll talk next week.
Okay.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A good Hasidic family is very concerned that their 30-year-old son, Jacob, is not yet married. So they call a shadchan, a matchmaker, and ask him to help find Jacob a good wife. The shadchan comes over to their house and spends a long time asking the parents what they want in a daughter-in-law. When the intake is complete, the shadchan takes a few days and asks to visit the family again. He tells them of a wonderful woman he's found. He says she's just the right age for Jacob. She keeps a glatt kosher home. She regularly goes to shul. She knows all the prayers by heart. She's a scholar. She's a wonderful cook. She loves children, and she wants to have a large family. And to top it all off, not that this should matter, she's gorgeous. Well, the parents are very impressed. They begin to get excited about the prospects of a wedding for Jacob in the near future. Finally, Jacob, who until now has been completely silent, asks, "Is she also good in bed?" To this, the shadchan replies, "Some say yes, some say no." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, our portion features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment, in a powerful and even theatrical way. To recap last week's events, the people of Israel have come to the borders of the Promised Land just 2 years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies comes back with a poor report. "We aren't strong enough to conquer the land," they say. Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. That rebellion fails, and a verdict is proclaimed. A lack of faith in God lies at the heart of the problem, and God has decided that this generation can never come into the holy promised land. They will have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years until they are all gone. Only then can a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth, untainted by slavery and its mentality, come forward into the promised land. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels, under the leadership of a priest, a Levite named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. Korach accuses his fellow Levites, Moses and Aaron, of chutzpah, hubris, overweening pride and egotism. Born into the same tribe, Korach is an insider rebelling against his own kin. "Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us?" he asks. His rebellion threatens the very foundation of the Israelites' leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, if it's all a matter of personal ego and self-aggrandizement, they might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery, as some now propose to do. But Korach, as so many demagogic leaders do, lies. Moses clearly has no great desire for high office. He has held it as a sacred trust given him, really thrust upon him by God. Korach's attack threatens God's authority. God's authority, not Moses. To determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great contest is held outdoors, a kind of religious sporting event. The final result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed. Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. It's always nice when God has your back. One lesson of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we should look in the mirror. The even more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, and that which is focused on personal aggrandizement, well, that Judaism will fail. Only through faith and devotion can we reach our own promised land. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Jeffrey Konis, will explore why he decided to use both research and his own imagination to create his new book on the Holocaust and its aftermath, The Conversations We Never Had. Find out when we come back here on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli novelist David Grossman has won the 2017 Man Booker International Prize. His novel, A Horse Walks Into a Bar, was announced as the winner last week at a dinner at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Grossman, who is now 63, is the author of more than 17 books of fiction and nonfiction, including To the End of the Land. A Horse Walks Into a Bar was published in Israel in 2014 and translated into English by Jessica Cohen. It's about a day in the life of a failing Israeli stand-up comedian and his memories of past loves, his Jerusalem neighborhood, and his Holocaust-surviving parents. The Man Booker International Prize has been awarded every 2 years since 2004. Grossman is the first Israeli to win the award. Others shortlisted for the prize this year were Grossman's fellow Israeli writer, Amos Oz, and the Argentinian Jewish writer, Samantha Schweblin. David Grossman attempted an ambitious high-wire act of a novel, and he's pulled it off spectacularly, said Nick Barley, director of the Edinburgh International Book Festival and chair of the Man Booker judging panel. A Horse Walks Into a Bar shines a spotlight on the effects of grief without sentimentality. The central character is challenging and flawed, but completely compelling. We were bowled over by Grossman's willingness to take emotional as well as stylistic risks. Every sentence counts. Every word matters in this supreme example of the writer's craft. The Man Booker International Prize comes with a £50,000 prize divided equally between the author and translator. The prize is sponsored by Man Group, an investment firm that also sponsors the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. In other literary and scholarly news, the members of the Modern Language Association voted to reject academic boycotts of Israel. The MLA announced last week the resolution passed by a vote of almost 2,000 to about 885. The resolution states, whereas endorsing the Palestinian campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel contradicts the MLA's purpose to promote teaching and research on language and literature. Whereas the boycott's prohibition of the evaluation of work of individual Israeli scholars conflicts with another resolution which condemns boycotts against scholars. And whereas endorsing the boycott could curtail debates with representatives of Israeli universities, such as faculty members, department chairs, and deans, thereby blocking possible dialogue and general scholarly exchange, be it resolved, the MLA refrains from endorsing the boycott. Resolutions calling for an academic boycott of Israeli universities routinely come before the MLA executive and membership and are always voted down. Several other academic groups in the U.S., however, including the American Studies Association, have passed resolutions calling for an academic boycott of Israel. Last June, the membership of the American Anthropological Association narrowly defeated a resolution to boycott Israeli academic institutions.
When I received the Nobel Prize for Literature, I got to wondering exactly how my songs related to literature. I wanted to reflect on it and see where the connection was. I'm going to try to articulate that to you, and most likely it will go in a roundabout way. But I hope what I say will be worthwhile and purposeful.
Bob Dylan has invented quotes by Abraham Lincoln. He's borrowed phrases from many poets in his songs, but never before has he been accused of, well, plagiarism, cribbing from Spark Notes, the online equivalent of Cliff Notes. In writing his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, which Dylan submitted last week, the legendary singer-songwriter apparently leaned heavily upon the guides that are so well used by students cramming for tests. After months of suspense, Dylan finally gave his lecture to the Nobel Academy in Los Angeles this month. The speech is a requirement to get the roughly $920,000 in prize money. The songwriter spoke about three classic books in his talk that left deep impressions on him, Moby Dick, All Quiet on the Western Front, and The Odyssey. Slate reporter Andrea Pitzer tipped off by a phrase Dylan uttered while talking about Moby Dick that wasn't actually in the book, dug into his speech. She found at least 20 sentences that bear some similarity to passages from Spark Notes. Bob Dylan has borrowed material from many other artists since the beginning of his career. Lots of his songs, even his paintings, quote heavily from others. Often it's unattributed. Still, the Nobel lecture may be less an artistic homage and more just the embarrassing equivalent of a homework assignment finished at the last minute. Dylan was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature back in October. He put off accepting for months. He finally found time in his schedule during a convenient tour stop in Sweden in March to accept the award. Then he gave his speech in June, that is, he recorded it, just days before the deadline set by the Nobel Committee. And there appears to be some confusion with a recent statement by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Palestinian Authority has not stopped paying salaries to the families of terrorists jailed in Israel, according to Israeli officials, which contradicts what Rex Tillerson said earlier last week. Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman, among other Israeli officials, said that they have not seen any change in the Palestinian Authority policy. Tillerson told senators at a meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee the policy had changed. Lieberman said, "I have not seen any indication that the Palestinian Authority stopped or intends to stop payments to terrorists and terrorists' families." "We are not aware of any change in the Palestinian Authority's policy, and as far as we know, they are still paying funds to terrorists' families. The Palestinian Authority continues to praise, incite, and encourage terror through financial support." Palestinians are also unaware of any supposed change in their policy. Issa Karaka, head of prisoner affairs for the Palestinian Authority, said this week that the payments have been made this month and will be made next month. "Almost every other household among the Palestinian people is the family of a prisoner or martyr," he said. "Anybody who thinks he can execute a decision like that is badly wrong." In his remarks before the Senate committee, Tillerson, speaking about the Palestinians, said, "We've been very clear with them that this is simply not acceptable to us. They have changed that policy, and their intent is to cease the payments to the families of those who have committed murder or violence against others." Or maybe not. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Jeffrey Konis, whose book is called The Conversations We Never Had, about the grandparents he really never knew, Holocaust survivors and the impact on the future generations. So explain a little bit, you do in the book, about how it was not really your grandmother who raised you. Tell us that story.
Sure. My father's mother died of natural causes just before the Germans came into Poland at the time, which later became Lithuania, into Vilna. His father had been arrested and murdered. He has no idea what happened to him. And this is all happening when my dad was 9 years old. His mother had a younger sister, Olga, who had been married. She was in the Kovno ghetto and then later transported to a concentration camp outside of Berlin, the name of which I don't know, but I suspect it was a satellite of the infamous Ravensbrück camp. After the war, she survived the camp. Her husband survived Dachau. She decided to go back to Vilna, where my dad is from, to find any remnants of the family. Did anyone survive? And my father was hidden by an illiterate Catholic peasant woman who had once at one time been his governess. And she had hidden him on a farm in the middle of nowhere, probably closer to Minsk, between Vilna and Minsk, which of course is the capital of Belarus. But in any event, she found that woman. That woman took her to my dad. And both women convinced my father that he had no life back there, that he should go with his aunt. So his aunt, Olga, took him back to Munich and put him into a Jewish orphanage where they were teaching the kids Hebrew and basically preparing them to go to then Palestine. My grandma Olga, or my father's aunt Olga, and her husband Bonya, or Benjamin, were planning to come to New York. At the very last minute, they decided, you know what, well, she really, frankly, made the decision to go get my father out of the orphanage and bring him with them. So they brought him to America, raised him as their own. And I had no idea she wasn't my real grandmother until I was about 15, 16.
Wow. How did you become aware of that?
It was no formal sit-down or announcement. It was very strange, actually. I was in my grandmother's apartment, and they were just talking, and usually they spoke Russian, but for whatever reason, they were having a conversation in English. And I picked up on something that didn't add up. I don't remember specifically what it was, but it was a very informal conversation. I said, but wait a minute, you know, and my father and Olga told me very matter-of-factly that, no, this, I'm, you know, your grandmother's sister.
Wow. Like, how did that...
Like nothing.
Yeah.
it was very strange. You'd think it'd be this major announcement. Jeff, I have something to tell you. But no, it didn't go down like that.
And how did that feel?
It didn't feel any differently. I mean, there's a very short chapter in the book about who's my real grandma. Is it my father's mother, who I never met, never knew, who had never met me, or my dad's aunt, who is flesh and blood of his, who raised him from a teenager, and she's the only quote-unquote grandma I've ever known? It didn't feel any different. You know, of course, I had a million questions for my dad, and what was particularly frustrating, he really didn't have a lot of answers.
So once you began to write about this, how much of it did you really have to imagine? Obviously, you did research. You knew a lot about the areas they were, but how much of it did you have to create?
Much of the book is true, and in fact, it drove my father crazy that I had to label it historical fiction, because he said so much of it was true, and he said even my speculation was more likely than not accurate. All of the conversations, almost all the conversations in the apartment, I had to imagine. The stories about her experience in the Holocaust, I imagined, but I also knew that they were plausible. I've always studied the Holocaust and heard and read and so forth. So I was pretty familiar with, as familiar as one can be, being a second and third generation survivor, if you will. So there's a story of her in the ghetto, a story of her in the transport, story of her in the camp, and so forth. So I did do a lot of research. For example, the name of the camp, I don't know if that was the actual camp, but it was an actual camp by that name, and I identify the commandant accurately, so who was there at the time, the fact that it had been liberated by the Russians and so forth. So as far as the historical aspects of the book, I did not have to imagine much. The conversations I had with her, of course, were figments of my imagination. but they're based, frankly, on my knowledge of her. And also a lot of it really involved internal debates that I had with myself. For example, you know, marrying a girl who isn't Jewish, but maybe if she converted, would that be good enough, if you will?
You know, I'm thinking about the many Holocaust memoirs that are not labeled fiction, but that we know even something as famous as Elie Wiesel's Night is a condensation of a much longer book. And of course, there's stories like, you know, Jerzy Kaczynski and others who kind of fabricated their own Holocaust experience. You really didn't, this isn't so much fiction, it's very much memoir in the same style as all of these other memoirs, which can only be a reflection of something of the time, isn't it?
I think so. And I do appreciate what you just said. You know, I had sat down with my dad on numerous occasions over the years and would ask him about, as much as he could tell me about his own experiences and Grandma Olga, I always refer to as Grandma Ola, about her experiences. But yes, it is, and I've been told that it is very memoirish in nature and tone and tenor. So it is, yes, what you're saying is 100% accurate. It's fictionalized, but, you know, I'd like to put a little asterisk next to the fictionalized part, I suppose.
What was the most difficult part about creating the book?
That's an easy question to answer. comes down to one word, pain. The pain of knowing this was a huge mistake, a terrible mistake on my part that I could never rectify no matter what I do or say. That I had an opportunity, not for a moment, not for an hour, not for a couple days, not over the course of a few visits, but over the course of living with her for 2.5 years, and she was a tremendous woman, a remarkable woman in terms of what she experienced, the grace and dignity with which she carried herself. And it would have taken such little effort on my part to learn so much from her, the last person in the world who could have told me so much about my dad as a little boy and about his background. And I am very inquisitive by nature, and I could not understand, and to this day I cannot understand for the life of me, why I did not ask her these questions. She would have loved to have been asked these questions. She would have loved to have had these conversations with me. And I do beat up myself a bit about not spending more time with her. I was going to law school at the time. I was under a lot of academic pressure, if you will. Any free time I had, the last thing I wanted to do was let's hang out with Grandma and chit-chat. We did chit-chat. We did have some small talk. I mentioned the fact that we would watch Jeopardy from time to time. There are certain conversations I had with her about smoking a cigarette and other evidence, if you will, of her dementia that was creeping in slowly but surely. Those are actual events, actual experiences. But the fact that I did not have those conversations with her, that alone was the most painful thing. And when I wrote the book, when I talk about it even now, it's emotional. It is painful. You know, I feel nothing but remorse and regret.
So besides beating yourself up, which is, of course, the central Jewish preoccupation, why do you think you didn't ask her?
I write it off to stupidity, self-absorption, and immaturity.
But do you think she really encouraged those kinds of questions?
No.
I mean, I think there's a subtle way sometimes that, and that many survivors talk about things very openly, but I've known some who really don't, and you don't feel comfortable asking, do you?
In general, no. I had given a talk at a local temple, and someone asked me that very question. But Grandma Ola, she would have told me anything and everything without a second thought. For example, one of the stories I have her telling me, I don't want to share it now because it's a powerful story, I think. She would tell me, because when I was in high school, I did speak to her a little bit about some of her Holocaust experiences. I don't remember any of the stories. I hadn't written any of them down. But I do recall her telling me some horrific stories, and she's sitting there smoking a cigarette, very calmly, very nonchalant, telling me horrific stories like it was nothing. Very matter-of-fact, like that was then, this is now. You know, you can't worry about the past, worry about the present, worry about the future. Worry about what you can control, not what you can't control. So she would have gladly She really would have. I've met a lot of Holocaust survivors who, as you allude to, would not be all that comfortable. My father and Olga are the exception, if you will. They really, that's what bothers me, because I know she would have been completely comfortable.
In creating the book, what was the easiest part?
That's a great question. The easiest part of the book. A lot of it was getting her language down, getting her mannerisms down. Those were the easiest things, because those were was based on firsthand experience, firsthand observation.
Sure.
So that was very easy. There's a section on my dad's story. Of course, that's very easy, but I have it told to me by Grandma Ola, because that's all factual. The hardest, you know, not that you had asked this question, but on the other side of the river, if you will, the hardest part were actually the stories about her firsthand experiences through my imagination in the Holocaust, because every single person had a very different experience during the Holocaust. They came out of it with a very different worldview. For example, some said God could not possibly allow this to happen. Other people may have had a reinforced belief in God. Those were very tricky to write, because I wanted it to sound real. I wanted it to sound actual. I didn't want it to sound Hollywood or being spewed out there for entertainment purposes. And what I've been, two of the best compliments I've received, frankly, one was that those descriptions were very realistic, and I've heard those from survivors, from two survivors. But the absolute best compliment I heard, and it goes to your initial question, the easiest part, comes from my dad, and that was, he had no idea that I knew my grandmother so well.
It's fascinating, because you're trying to capture somebody that you knew, but that you didn't really have the opportunity to interview, explore, you know, find out these deep truths about the experience, and that you convey it in such a powerful and clean and factual way. If you had the opportunity to ask her one question now, what would it be?
Rabbi, you've asked me a very difficult question. The one question.
I'm a rabbi. I'm supposed to ask hard questions. It's my job.
I guess it's part of the job. I would ask her what my grandparents were like. Because that would entail a rather broad general response. What were they like as husband and wife? What was my grandmother like as a sister? What were they like as parents?
The book is called Conversations We Never Had, The Conversations We Never Had by Jeffrey Konis. Where can people go to find out more about it and more about you?
They can find out about me at Amazon. Amazon's probably the best bet.
The source for everything, no.
There you go. Amazon, the Yoda of the internet world.
It is.
And that is a lot about the book, a lot about me. Outskirts Press, the publisher of the book, also has information. But when I go to the Amazon site, which isn't like every day, but when I do go to it, there is a lot on me and a lot about the book. There are a lot of reviews, not just from people who bought the book, but there are a lot of third-party reviews about the book, and they're giving their impressions.
Thank you so much, and good luck with the book, and interested to see what your next project is.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
My pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, the president of CLAL, the Center for Learning and Leadership, wonderful Jewish organization. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Itai Levy. It's called Perach Bashmama. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
לך את השיר מהסרט הישן שכל כך אהבנו איך אותך אני מכיר כמה זה עושה לי טוב לזכור תמיד כל מה שעברנו בלי לומר מילה דיברנו כל הלילה בלי לומר מילה והשקט יפה פה איך השקט יפה בלי לומר מילה זה כתוב לך בעיניים בלי לומר מילה את לי בחישר פה את לי בחישר פה ורק בשממה כל כך שונה עד שמש בלילות שר בשני קולות ורק בשממה כל כך שונה את מתנה שמש בלילות קץ לשאלות
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.